It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Over the last quarter century, the implementation of sustainable values and practices has been growing in frequency when it comes to developments, buildings, schools, and in communities. One of the leaders of that movement has been the Green Building Alliance of Pittsburgh, which is celebrating its 25th anniversary. Jenna Kramer is the new executive director of the Green Building Alliance. Jenna, welcome to the Confluence.
Thank you so much for having me, Kevin.
So let's start with, for people who don't know, what the Alliance is. So who's involved and who does it benefit?
Sure. So Green Building Alliance, we use the word alliance because we like to say that we are a network of individuals and committed stakeholders really working to advance sustainability throughout the region. And to us, that means creating economically, environmentally, and socially vibrant places for everyone. So our work is really to also benefit everyone in those efforts.
You have been with the Alliance for 10 of those 25 years, as I said, new as executive director. Has the approach, has the mission changed?
Yes, I would say, you know, Pittsburgh is known as a leader nationally for our work in green building. Green Building Alliance is actually the first green building organization in the entire country, thanks to a group of committed individuals and nonprofits, and also the insight and thought leadership of local funders who knew that our spaces and places truly impacted the quality of life for all people. And so when green building started 25 years ago, a lot of it was about trying to advance best practices in our building practices, but our knowledge was around different techniques and technologies. And over the years, research has grown to better understand how a lot of that can innovate and evolve. And so our mission and work as an organization, we better understand now human health impacts of the built environment, social equity opportunities of the built environment, and even innovation in a lot of the way that we go about building, operating, designing our places.
We're having this conversation in a studio, WESA. It's in the Community Broadcast Center, the first LEED certified radio station in the country. Now, I want to say 10, 12, 15 years ago, it might have been maybe a bit unusual to have a green building. But now, is it more common than not in having a green building?
I would say that the growth in green building has definitely, we've seen that over the years. We definitely have some room to grow, but for a lot of the early adopters and innovators, they continue to take that and expand their practices. And I think their stories and leadership and also what they can show as far as return on investment has encouraged a lot of other people to think about green building as wanting, you know, being taking that on as part of their practices as well.
And green's a word that we throw around, but yeah. What is truly meant if a project is green?
So there are many facets of it, and that continues to grow over the years as we know more. So green can be anything from reducing our environmental impact by looking at things like energy use and water consumption. But it's also about a lot of health impacts, like indoor air quality and the materials we choose to use. There are things like daylighting and views to the outdoors, how people feel in a space, the beauty of our spaces, and integration of innovative technologies, including things like renewable energy and other types of savings to impact how we're using our resources.
When you're starting from scratch, it's one thing. But are there companies or strategies that managers of older buildings can turn to if they want to retrofit their space into something that is more sustainable, more green?
Yes, definitely. And that's also something that has expanded over the years, that we see more existing buildings taking on green building operations and maintenance practices. We have many great case studies here in Pittsburgh as well. For example, the David L. Lawrence Convention Center is seen as an international flagship for how you can take your operations and maintenance and really improve energy and water savings over time. We also have a lot of existing historic buildings in the region that are doing much more accessible practices to retrofit or implement best practices to reduce energy and water use.
Speaking of reducing energy, reducing water use, the Pittsburgh 2030 district. It's one of about 20 cities, urban areas in the nation. What is the 2030? What are the aims?
Sure. Yes. So the Pittsburgh 2030 district is actually the largest 2030 district out of all 20 in the country. And the goals of the 2030 district are for building owners to reduce energy use, water consumption, and transportation emissions by 50% by 2030. And Pittsburgh also added on a fourth component by trying to improve the indoor air quality of those spaces.
So do you have a measuring stick yet as far as, okay, we're still a dozen years away from 2030, but do you know where you are toward that goal of reducing by 50%?
Yes. So measuring the performance is key to this initiative so that people understand where they are now and where they need to go and what practices and implementation they need in order to reach those goals. And to date, through GBA's tracking, we know that the Pittsburgh 2030 district has reduced energy usage by 12% and water consumption by 14.5%. We are still working on establishing a transportation baseline, which we're launching a Make My Trip Count survey to try to get more data from Pittsburghers to understand how they commute to work.
Right.
And we know that since we launched in 2012, that we also helped save $86 million in energy and water use data alone.
Okay, so a lot of figures there.
Sure.
You're making progress toward it. Is it a matter of just getting more buildings, more organizations, more people signing on? Is that what can do it? Or is it more extensive practices that they would have to adopt to get to that goal?
Sure. It's both and, because those are cumulative numbers. Mm-hmm. This year, we also introduced an affiliate property program, which means that any building, even outside of the established districts, can take part in achieving these goals and signing on to these efforts. So we definitely want to get more buildings, but we also know that the buildings that are engaged are trying to implement more extensive measures and renovation practices in order to achieve those goals by 2030.
When we first started talking, I mentioned the 25th anniversary. There was a celebration.
Yes.
25 projects were acknowledged through the years that were completed during that quarter century. Schools, hospitals, the David L. Lawrence Convention Center, a neighborhood, and even a supermarket. That's an interesting mix of projects that I don't think a lot of us would think of. A neighborhood, a supermarket, in being involved in green building.
That's right. So establishing what those 25 projects were when we have hundreds of green buildings in the region was difficult. And we wanted to make sure that we were touching on all different sectors and geographies within our region, and to show that we have all different types of building owners, building types, and building users that implement green building practices. And so these examples really show that it's possible, whether you're a school, whether you're a business, whether you're healthcare, higher education, a community institution, that green building can show up differently in all of those places, but all of those can be drivers for change.
Among those 25 that were honored, acknowledged, involve two, and Pittsburgh is one of only two cities, U.S. cities, to claim two fully certified living buildings, Phipps Conservatory and Botanical Garden Center for Sustainable Landscapes and the Frick Environmental Center. What's the other city? So one of two cities that has two.
Seattle.
Okay, Seattle, which seems to make sense.
Yes.
Because they're very progressive. How difficult is it to have living building status?
It's pretty difficult, and that's why they call it a challenge for a reason. And it takes the early innovators and adopters to really take that challenge on, because it's not just about trying to incrementally do better with your buildings, but getting to a more net positive impact on the place and on people. So it's very difficult, but we have more and more buildings and communities interested in that challenge regionally, because we understand all of the benefits that can come to people through their health, through equity, through a lot of the practices that are involved in achieving those living buildings. So they require net positive energy. So putting more energy back than you're taking, net positive water, many, many, an extensive list. And if you talk to the people who did those projects, they could tell you how visionary they were, but how satisfying it was to make that accomplishment.
We have just 2 minutes left.
Sure.
You mentioned the Make My Trip Count survey. This is a follow-up to one from 3 years ago. This one's more extensive, a broader area that you're covering?
It is a broader area. We did a survey in 2015, and we're doing it again. We hope to reach many more thousands of respondents, and we really want to understand how Pittsburghers commute and get to work, and it helps inform decision makers who are making transportation decisions for the long term. And so people can learn more about it at makemytripcount.org.
Okay, so and that will go until when?
That will go until the end of October.
Okay, and informed decision about transportation. Are we talking mass transit, bike lanes, other stuff?
Everything, all mobility options.
All right, Jenna, in our remaining minute,
sure.
I wanted to ask you, we did mention some of the projects over the last 25 years, but there were some innovations that will set new standards for the city, maybe even for the nation, do you think, in the years ahead?
I think the innovations come at looking at a lot of the issues beyond just individual buildings and how do we get to scale. And our work, even at GBA, is looking at how can we make every building and every community sustainable so that every person can thrive. And that means really looking beyond and figuring out what are the networks, what are the stakeholders, how do we bring more people to the table? Because we know that innovation can spur when we start to think about it on a larger scale.
And thinking about who is all impacted by those decisions.
Right. Who is all impacted? Many communities that have not been part of the process. And we want every student to attend a healthy school. We want every person to live in a healthy community and everyone to have access to these types of healthy and sustainable places.
Jenna Kramer is the new executive director of the Green Building Alliance, celebrating 25 years. Jenna, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much, Kevin.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Megan Harris. Coming up on The Confluence, dangerous incidents around natural gas pipelines are rare, but in Pennsylvania, the lines are increasingly all around us. How can homeowners steel themselves mentally for the possibility of disaster? Or should they accept they're probably pretty safe? And cutbacks for legacy media, especially newspapers embedded in communities for more than a century, have created gaps in coverage for local news. We'll discover one program designed to engage and assist young journalists to fill that void and turn a media desert into a media oasis. Stay tuned to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
Like a moth to the flame, we're quite often drawn to what is bad for us. Beds of fire with passionate love give way to knives and skewers and eventually holes in the wall inlaid. A song from the Manchester rock band called James.
This bed is on fire with passion and love. The neighbors complain about the noises above. But she only comes when she's on top.
Turbulent relationships have long played a role in popular music, but James sure made them sound fun. James released Laid 25 years ago today. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Trump administration is holding 3 hearings this week on its plan to roll back Obama-era vehicle emission standards. One of those hearings was in Pittsburgh yesterday. WESA's Amy Sisk, who covers the energy economy, was at the hearing. She joins us in studio now. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning, Kevin.
So let's start with what is currently in place and which took effect during the Obama administration. What was the goal of those standards?
Yeah, so the Obama administration in 2012 imposed a rule that would essentially require automakers to make vehicles more fuel efficient. And so that would ramp up over time through 2025. And by 2025, automakers had to get vehicles up to about 50 miles per gallon, which was about double what was the case in 2012. And then on top of that, they were also requiring automakers to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions that escape through vehicles' tailpipes.
So what does the EPA, Department of Transportation, want to do instead of what was enacted during the Obama administration?
So the Trump administration's Environmental Protection Agency and then also the Department of Transportation have proposed a new rule that would essentially roll back some of what the Obama administration had done. So rather than require gas mileage to get up to 50 miles per gallon by 2025, it would freeze it at the level required by 2020. So that would be about 37 miles per gallon. And then on top of that, there's one other key point here, and that is that states, particularly California, a number of years ago received a waiver from the federal government that allows them to set stricter levels than what the federal government requires. And so about a dozen other states have followed California's lead there, including Pennsylvania. And the Trump administration is proposing to revoke those states' abilities to create their own limits.
So the feds set their own limit.
Yes.
And that's it.
Yes.
Okay. So it was a day-long hearing, as I mentioned. Let's hear from one of the people you spoke with, Matthew Mihalik, executive director of the Pittsburgh-based Breathe Project.
This proposed rule makes no sense whatsoever. It would just add to an already burdened region. Vehicles are a second leading source of air pollution, and why would we choose to put a rule in place that would make that more impactful?
All right. So was there a mix of testimony? Was it mostly against? What was it?
So about 140 people were scheduled to speak at this hearing yesterday. Overwhelmingly, the people that I heard from at that hearing opposed the Trump administration's effort to roll back these rules. And a lot of their concerns echoed what Matthew Mihalik just said. You know, Pittsburgh is a region not known for having great air quality, and a lot of concerns stemmed around that. So we heard from city officials, from county officials, that echoed similar concerns. And then we also heard from bigger national groups as well, the American Lung Association, the Union of Concerned Scientists, folks like that. And I think one of the key points to bring up here is that this was one of the Obama administration's signature climate policies, and so they would like to see that carried out rather than rolled back.
All right. Very quickly, people in support of this, car manufacturers, oil companies?
Yep. So the Trump administration's argument here really stems around the issue of safety, and if vehicles are less fuel efficient, then they will be cheaper, and so people will be more willing to purchase newer vehicles, and newer vehicles, by nature of being newer, having the best technology, are safer, and so people would be getting into fewer auto fatalities that way.
WESA's Amy Sis covers energy economy in Pennsylvania. Amy, thanks so much.
Thanks, Kevin.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. This month, major explosions involving gas pipelines rocked communities in Beaver County and near Boston, causing evacuations and destroying homes. One young man was killed in the Massachusetts explosion. Dangerous incidents are rare, but Pennsylvania is in the midst of a pipeline building boom, including the Mariner East 2, which is supposed to come online soon. As part of our State Impact Pennsylvania series this week, Marie Cusick has more on why our brains are wired to be wary of certain things like pipelines.
Phil Stober runs an organic farm in Lebanon County. It's right next to the new Mariner East 2 pipeline. When the line is fully up and running, it will transport natural gas liquids 350 miles across the southern part of the state.
You know, you're aware that it's there, and you just go about your day like all the other things that could befall a person, a car accident, a lightning strike, you know, a terrorist attack that we're all aware of nowadays. It's just one more element to think about.
He said he laughed out loud when the company building it sent him a mailer with its evacuation plan. Energy Transfer Partners warned that he would not be able to see or smell a leak, but he must avoid creating any kind of spark, even ringing a doorbell, and head upwind, away from an invisible, odorless cloud of highly flammable things like ethane, propane, and butane.
The information you get from Sunoco Energy Transfer Partners is don't start your car, don't use your cell phone, and just, you know, run away.
Many things play into how people perceive risk, according to David Ropeek, who's studied some of the biggest fear factors, and pipelines hit on a lot of them. For one thing, he says people rarely get to choose whether a pipeline will run through their property. Companies like Energy Transfer Partners are often granted eminent domain.
Pipelines are imposed on us. We don't volunteer to have one built under our house or near our house. If we did, we wouldn't be as afraid.
And the Mariner East project is a set of export pipelines. So a lot of Pennsylvanians are being asked to live next door to something that may not bring them benefits, but carries a risk. Also, if something goes wrong, it could be devastating.
We overfear low probability risks if they cause us to die in really nasty ways.
Researchers call this the dread factor.
We freak out about shark attacks. They're not likely to happen.
But it can happen. On average, sharks kill about 6 people globally each year. A man was killed earlier this month in Massachusetts.
The attack happened on a stretch of the Cape Cod National Seashore.
In the U.S., pipelines have killed an average of 17 people per year and injured 65 per year over the past two decades.
It's not the odds of dying, it's the nature of how you get dead. And being blown up or burning to death carries the awfulness factor.
As a former journalist turned author and consultant, Ropeik has advised groups, including the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and pipeline companies, about how humans perceive risk. He also says it matters if we trust the other people involved.
So if a risk comes from somebody we trust, it won't bother us as much as if it comes from somebody we don't trust. And the fossil fuel industry has been painted as super uber bad guys.
Situations can seem scarier if we don't feel in control, according to Stephen Brumell, an associate professor of social and decision sciences at Carnegie Mellon University. Think about flying in an airplane, which is statistically a very safe thing to do, versus driving a car. Fatal crashes kill tens of thousands of people on U.S. roadways every year.
When you're driving a car, you have the wheel in your hands, and you may feel like you're such a great driver that you can remove yourself from dangerous situations.
But even the best driver can't control the behavior of the other people on the road.
And it's that feeling of control that is really the key. It's not about whether you're actually in control.
It also matters whether a risk feels familiar or unfamiliar. The less people know about something, the scarier it can seem. But riskiness often can mean more to people than simply looking at the probability of fatalities. No matter what the statistics are, Brumell says people need to be heard.
The perceptions that people have should be treated as valid. And what we need to understand is why they feel that way before we can figure out if it's right or wrong to feel that way.
Back on his farm in Lebanon County, Stober is not happy about the Mariner East pipeline, and he's joined a local group fighting it. But he said he doesn't lay awake at night over the possibility of it hurting him personally. He's more worried about the bigger global threat of burning fossil fuels, climate change.
That's what really troubles me, and it's cooking the planet right now.
Whether a pipeline leaks and contributes greenhouse gases or blows up in a terrifying fireball, people will interpret threats differently. But the risks are real. Marie Cusick, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among WESA, WHYY, WITF, and the Allegheny Front to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy. You're listening to The Confluence. It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. Cutbacks by legacy media, especially newspapers embedded for communities for more than a century, have created gaps in coverage of local news. But one program wants to engage and assist young journalists to fill that media void. Andrew Conti is the director of Point Park Center for Media Innovation. He's joined in the studio by McKeesport area students Isaiah Johnson and Serenity Moorfield. Welcome to all of you. Good to have you here.
Well, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Andy, tell us about the McKeesport Media Oasis Project and why McKeesport.
So I run the Center for Media Innovation at Point Park University, and when I started that job, we've been open 2 years, and I started thinking about this problem of media deserts where newspapers have either closed or they've shrunk their coverage areas. And so you end up with these places that no longer have local news. And we knew McKeesport, they had the Daily News for 131 years until it closed at the end of 2015. And so when it closed, then you have the city of 20,000 residents, and there's really no local source of news other than a couple of online things or some area newspapers that do some stories there. But for the residents who live there, it's like suddenly they no longer have a place to go for the obituaries or for good news or for even just, you know, finding out what's going on in the community.
So the project that these students are doing might not actually have been covered, might have been missing from the coverage if the McKeesport Daily News had been around, basically, because it's not around.
Right. I mean, this grew out of the fact that the Daily News isn't there any longer.
Right.
Those areas are called news deserts. And so when we got together the first time, we said, well, let's figure out a way to see if we can get young people telling their own stories and taking their own photographs and doing something to give their perspective on the community. And when we got together, we said, well, what should we call it? And right away, everybody was like, well, what about an oasis? So let's call it a media oasis. And so that's what we've been working on, is this idea of getting the students to go out and do their own stories, take their own photographs, and just talk about their community from their own perspective.
And how did you start this? You talked to some of the locals in the community or what before you started?
So in addition to running the center, I'm in the PhD program at Point Park. And one of my the students in my cohort, Keno Fitzpatrick, I said I wanted to do this in McKeesport, and he said, well, I run this after-school program called YouthCast in McKeesport. Let's get together. And so we combined forces, and we brought the students into the center one day, and then we went down there and started talking with them, and things just snowballed from there.
So two of the students involved in the McKeesport Media Oasis program are with us in studio, and we're so pleased. I'm going to ask you to introduce yourselves, and why did you originally want to get involved? Serenity, we'll start with you.
My name is Serenity Moorfield. I'm in 10th grade. And I wanted to do it because I just wanted to be involved with stuff, like, you know, not just to be known for something, but, you know, it's a good thing to do. And so I just felt like, you know, we could do something, you know, as youth, you know, people can listen to us and share, because we are the next generation. So, you know, we can make it better, because everything that's going out here, all you hear is bad news and stuff. But when you hear about us, you know, that gives people hope. You know, something that's going good. Mm-hmm. You know, that's why I wanted to do it.
Isaiah.
Hi, my name is Isaiah Johnson. And the reason I wanted to get into this program is because there's more to McKeesport that people think. And we're bringing out the best in McKeesport, because all people hear is bad news about it. And like Serenity said, and we're trying to change that to make McKeesport a good place to live and stop.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, Andy mentioned the part of the project included asking you, the participants, because you're two of, I believe, 14 participants, to describe what you wanted to talk about and how you wanted to tell those stories. So what topics interested you most?
Like my story?
Yes, that you wanted to explore.
I just did like a body image type of essay, well, like a story, because I deal with it for myself. And so I kind of wanted, like, you know, people that are dealing with the same thing to look up at my story, to give them, you know, just to look up to it. Like, I did go through, like, you know, depression about myself. But now, you know, I'm better than ever. Like, if anybody else that has a problem, you know, I'm right there to have, like, a talking, because, you know, I relate to you, and that's what I was talking about, because people usually just go behind closed doors and shut out, but that's not a good thing. You're supposed to, you know, talk about it and let it out, and that's what I thought writing this would give it, you know, open up their mind, just, you know, you have to let it out sometimes.
Did it help you, and do you think it will help others who might identify with you?
Yes, it did, and I think it will help other people, because when they see this, you know, written down, you know, see what I went through, that's, you know, can relate to them, and, you know, they can open up like I did, and, you know, be like me and do stuff like this, and, you know.
Mm-hmm. I say, so what was your interest when Andy first broached that to you? Say, what do you like? What do you want to explore? So what was it?
My favorite interest was to interview people in McKeesport about, like, their lives, because there's more than just everybody in McKeesport having the same story. Everybody has different stories. Everybody's going through different things. So that was my favorite part. I really love that, because I got to meet different people with different personalities and had different opinions on different things.
So you got to meet people. You're obviously not shy. You just approached them and said, I'd like to talk to you about?
Yes. And we had some people take pictures of our interviews that we had. We interviewed a lot of people at our pop-up in place. And we also walked the streets of McKeesport interviewing people and getting their insight on and take on things.
Andy, so how did you sort of adapt to merge those interests or even help facilitate the conversations into journalism that could be shared in this McKeesport Media Oasis pilot program?
So the thing for us was not to go in and say, this is how you do journalism, or here we are to save you and McKeesport. We're going to tell you what to do. It was to go to the young people and say, well, what do you want to talk about? What are the things that are important to you? And then letting them figure out how they could tell those stories. We gave them the skills, but they had the topics and what they wanted to write about and think about.
You didn't try to impose someone else's voice on their voice.
No, it was super important to, you know, we cleaned up their grammar when we did the final product, but in terms of their voice, this is their own perspective. Their own voice is what they feel about the community, and it's exciting to hear them talk about it, you know, like with Serenity, with she wrote a really challenging piece on body image and her own personal experience, and then to have her talk about how she feels about that experience and why she did it and that she's hoping to help other people. That's our whole thing with this Media Oasis project, is that if there's no local news outlet, if there's no place where people can have that kind of a conversation, then these stories just kind of disappear. And so we want to create a situation where residents can take control of the media and they can actually start to give back to their community by telling their stories.
So, Renee, I want to ask you, does that take a certain amount of courage to talk about yourself, your own story?
Yes, I could say like 2 years ago, like 2 years like from now, I know I wouldn't be able to talk about this right now. I'd probably be breaking down crying about every single thing. But now I'm looking back, if anything, I'm proud of myself. So I'm not like, you know, breaking down, proud of it. So
Isaiah mentioned taking photos going around the community. Andy, you also enlisted a well-known, yeah, well-respected photographer.
Yeah, so Martha Ryle, the Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer from the Post-Gazette, helped us out with it. She came down and she led the students on photo safaris. It was her idea. We would go out, oh, and we got them digital cameras from Point Park. And the students went out and they wandered the streets in groups, and we helped them. Part of it was they had to start talking to strangers and taking their photographs. And they were like, everyone tells us not to talk to strangers, and now you're telling us to do it. But yeah, Martha really helped them, you know, start to see their community and be able to put it, you know, make pictures that show the way they look at the community.
Right. Serenity and Isaiah, I asked you at the beginning why you wanted to get involved in this project. So I'm going to ask you now, as it's moved along, what did you enjoy most about the project? Isaiah, let's start with you.
Me personally, my favorite part was when we had the fire chief in our...
like a clubhouse, right?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So they have a clubhouse in City Hall. They have the, yeah, top floor of City Hall.
And the clubhouse of City Hall. And we were asking them extremely deep questions and getting really good answers. And, like, we all copied it down. And we got to, like, the heart of, like, why he wanted to be a fire chief. And,
right.
And it was a really good experience for me.
Serenity, we just mentioned a moment ago that this is a courageous act on your part. But did you enjoy the process? What was your favorite part of this?
The favorite part of, like, the program?
Yeah.
The favorite part was when I brought my uncle to the place. I brought my uncle to the youth cast so we can interview him. And, you know, he gave them, you know, advice about college, about, you know, friendship, you know, about just relationships and just about, you know, going on in life in general and how not having no regrets and stuff. So that was my thing, because I think everybody else got, like, an intake to take that, you know, so they can go farther with that.
Andy, I've known you for a number of years. You've been a journalist your whole working life. So what's it like for you to sort of be in that position now to pass on those skills, advise, help?
It feels empowering. I love when young people get excited about telling their stories. They start out thinking, well, I don't really have anything to say, or I don't have a way to say it. And then you start having conversation about what they care about, and then you start showing them how they can make photographs and how they can put their words together. And it's really exciting and powerful. I love it, and you know, looking forward to seeing how we can grow the program in McKeesport.
Yeah, journalism, let's face it, at its essence, is storytelling.
Right.
And if you identify that, then people have stories to tell.
Yeah, and the students got right away when we started talking with them about the things they were concerned about their community, that if there's no newspaper, if nobody's having that conversation, those things aren't going to ever be addressed. And so for them, that was important to start bringing out some of these topics as well.
All right. These two fine students who have written, have gone out and done stories for this publication, they've been very subdued about their own accomplishments. So brag on them.
Oh, yeah. No, they've done a tremendous job. I mean, it was terrific for both Serenity and Isaiah. From my perspective, it was interesting to watch them come into the program and be reluctant to say anything, and then to see them really blossom. And so, like Isaiah, we did a bunch of programs in the summer. We'd go out to playgrounds, and it was awesome. By the time we got to the second or third week, he was coming, grabbing his pen and notebook, and going up to people and asking them questions and having really good conversations with them, with, you know, police officers and with older residents. It wasn't just people in their own age cohort either. They were out talking to everybody. And for Serenity, it's like I said, it's just been great to see her really use this opportunity to express herself. I think she's got such a powerful voice and so many things to say, and I want to make sure that she continues to feel like she has a place where she can put her words out there.
We have just 3 minutes left. I want to ask you, Andy, did you have a specific set of goals going in, and do you feel like you've achieved them?
Yes, so the goal was to create a situation where people who live there could start to tell their own stories. And we're doing a celebration on Saturday where we're going to celebrate the stories that the kids have done. And we put together a booklet with all their stories and we put them on the internet. So, yeah, for me, this has been a big success.
Serenity and Isaiah, of all you've learned, what do you think is going to stick with you as you continue to grow? What's going to stick with you, Serenity?
Everything. I can't just pick just one thing. It's everything. Just the experience that I have.
Okay.
And that I know. The knowledge that I now know is just going to stick with me forever. And the people, you know, the adults that speak to me and everything.
Isaiah, what's going to stick with you?
The thing that's going to stick with me is the friendships I made through YouthCast. And I'd like to thank Andrew Conti for being there.
Oh, wow.
A lot.
Here's your $20.
And I'd like to thank Officer Julian Thomas because he inspired me. When I interviewed him, just his answers were just very inspiring and helped me.
All right, Andy, a minute or so. Would you do it again, and where would you do it?
Yes, so we're starting to plan out the next phase. Like I said, my academic partner, Keno Fitzpatrick from YouthCast, he and I are talking about what this starts to look like. High school educator out there in McKeesport, Bonnie Butler, she reached out to us, and she's hoping to get the high school newspaper students involved in the next phase of it. And so if we can get the YouthCast students working on the high school newspaper and getting the high school newspaper students working on this program and telling community stories, that's going to be really great. We had support from the Pittsburgh Foundation and from the community development program at Point Park. So it's all been terrific, and we're looking forward to the next phase.
Very good. Very briefly, Serenity, Isaiah, would you recommend this to other students, other kids you know?
Yes. Yes, I would.
And what about you, Isaiah?
I would.
All right. I understand that there's a celebration this weekend. Is that correct?
Right. So we're all getting together at McKeesport Area Senior High School on Saturday to show off their stories. We've got big posters of the photographs they've taken, and to go back to the community and say, like, here's what the young people in your community, the stories they've told.
And Andy, finally, where can we find their work? We want to hear it. We want to read it. We want to hear it.
Yeah, so you can go to our website, thecenterformediainnovation.com, and we'll have links on there to their book and their stories and everything else.
Check out those fabulous stories. I have them in front of me right now. You will be amazed, you'll be impressed, and you'll be proud about the future journalists for this region. Andrew Conti is the director of Point Park Center of Media Innovation. Isaiah Johnson is in the 7th grade McKeesport Founders Middle School. Serenity Moorfield is in 10th grade at McKeesport High School. Thanks so much to all of you for being here.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. On our next program, a new report indicates about 1 in 3 Pennsylvania adults is obese. We'll visit with Allegheny County Health Department Director Karen Hacker about making our communities, our residents, healthier. And are voters willing to approve a tax hike on themselves for early learning and after-school programs for children? Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. production assistance from Mix Dinelli. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.